Chapter 8 Conundrums. Without the noose, without the gag. At dawn on Tuesday, Robert Alton Harris, a double murderer, died in a California gas chamber, California's first execution in 25 years. There's no doubt that Harris deserved to die. In my view, however, California should not have killed him. Not because there is anything unconstitutional about the death penalty. The Fifth Amendment takes it as a given. Moreover, capital punishment may be cruel, but it is not unusual. A measure that is approved by 36 states can hardly be deemed one against which Americans have turned their face, which is what unusual means in constitutional terms. Nor is there any high principle that the state may not put people to death. There are reasons of state, war, for example, for which the state will put tens of thousands of people to death, and risk the lives of thousands of its own innocents as well. Nor is capital punishment unjust. Indeed, justice is the most powerful argument in favor of capital punishment. When a man wantonly kills two boys, as did Harris, it is hard to think of any penalty short of death that would restore the moral order that has been so brutally violated. Nonetheless, I oppose capital punishment on the following grounds. It is a mark of civilization to maintain order at the lowest possible level of official violence. One is not supposed to talk these days about higher and lower levels of civilization, but even political correctness would admit that the less a society has recourse to official violence, the more civilized it is. We do not cut off the hands of thieves. We do not keel-haul miscreant sailors. We no longer have public floggings. Each abolition represents an advance of civilization. Abolition of the death penalty represents a further advance. I do not oppose capital punishment in principle. If capital punishment could be demonstrated to deter murder, I might be persuaded to tolerate a few exemplary hangings to save many innocents. But there is no convincing evidence that the death penalty deters. Murder rates in states with the death penalty are just as high as in neighboring states without it. In states where the death penalty has been introduced, murder rates do not on average go down. And in states where the death penalty has been abolished, murder rates do not go up. When something as barbaric as cold-blooded execution by the state makes no appreciable contribution to public safety, it deserves abolition. True, justice militates for capital punishment. But on balance, it seems to me worth foregoing the satisfactions of perfect justice, as all of Western Europe has done, to live in a society civilized enough to maintain order without judicial killing. Now, this kind of argument against the death penalty may have useful application to issues other than capital punishment. The idea of choosing a course that makes for a more refined, more advanced, more civilized society can be of help in thinking our way through political conundrums that are otherwise reduced to a clash of irreconcilable principles. Take free speech, for example. We have a serious debate in this country, particularly in the universities, over the establishment of legal codes outlawing racist, sexist, or otherwise hostile speech. Several democracies, Canada and Germany, for example, have laws banning the advocacy of racist ideas. I would oppose such laws for the United States, again, not on grounds of principle, but on grounds that today and in this country, such laws are an unnecessary infringement on liberty and thus unworthy of an advanced democracy. Nazism, communism, and other intolerant extremisms are laughably marginal in American politics. David Duke's 15-minute rise and fall had made the point once again. Nonetheless, if someday some totalitarians posed a real challenge to our system of liberty, as did the Nazis to Weimar, I could see no reasonable argument against their suppression, forcible if necessary. In a time of clear and present danger, liberty is not obliged to commit suicide. Lincoln certainly did not think so when he suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, but we do not live in such a time of extreme danger. Far from it. Totalitarians are a fringe of the fringe. So long as they remain so, why diminish the first of all rights, speech, to deal with a threat that is not a threat? Which brings us to the speech codes now being imposed in the universities. In principle, there might be a situation in which one would countenance such limits on speech. In the midst of an epidemic of racial and ethnic hostility that made normal life and scholarly discourse impossible, one might be willing to suspend the traditional rules and outlaw certain kinds of speech. But we are nowhere near such a situation. Where the situation does not apply, neither should curtailments of speech. Thus, those who oppose capital punishment or who oppose speech codes need not do so in the name of some holy principle that the state may not take away life or liberty. It may, but on the grounds that an advanced, civilized society should strive to preserve public order and social peace with an absolute minimum of official violence to life and liberty. Someday, some emergency might warrant the state aggressively hanging criminals and gagging dissidents, but until that day, it would be a credit to our society to try to get by without the noose and the gag. The Washington Post, April 24, 1992. Motherhood Missed. The screaming headline was tabloid size. I was desperate for a baby, and I have the medical bills to prove it. Some love-struck movie star? A lesbian celebrity? No. Germaine Greer, icon of 20th-century feminism. I still have pregnancy dreams, she confessed movingly in the premiere issue of the British magazine Aura, waiting with vast joy and confidence for something that will never happen. The longing for children is hardly novel. What, then, makes this story so sensational, earning a 45-point type, exclusive treatment? What gives the story its man-bites-dog quality is that Greer is the great exemplar of the fiercely independent, aggressively sexual new woman. Iconoclastic to the point of fierceness, she reveled in her lovers and in telling about them. The one adjective rarely attached to Greer was domestic. And now she reveals the hollowness that haunts her, the terrible sorrow she feels at what she lost, her chance for motherhood. Many years ago, she now writes, she cared for the infant girl of a friend. Ruby lit up my life in a way that nobody, certainly no lover, has ever done. I was not prepared for the incandescent sensuousness of this small child, the generosity of her innocent love. Not prepared? Why? Because, to the uncompromising feminism of those early days, she writes, childbearing was constricting, suffocating, an enemy of a liberated woman's larger hopes. Getting pregnant meant the end of all good times. The mother generation warned us darkly not to rush into childbearing, to have a good time while we could. And now, like Hannah, she weeps. Greer is not the only such victim of ideology, and, it must be added, biology. When she finally decided to try to say yes to having a child, her body said no. At the 1998 Barnard commencement, Joyce Pernick of the New York Times spoke of her deep regret at not having had a child. She felt that she had to choose between family and career. Her choice? The long days, the undivided attention, the single-minded ambition to succeed. I am absolutely convinced I would not be the Metro editor of the Times if I had had a family. The poignancy of her dilemma lies in the lingering question. If she had it to do over again, would she still rather have the Metro desk or the soft comforts and inexpressible joys of motherhood? In modern times, we suffer not for our sins, sin having been abolished, but for ideology. The traditional victim of ideology is the communist betrayed by the God that failed. As socialism recedes into history, there will be fewer such confessions. Feminism, a far nobler creed, commands the day. But like all gods, this one too exacts its tribute. The early days of feminism did present stark choices. It was held, as Pernick put it, that you cannot have it all. Unfair it was. Unfair it remains. Should men and women who have taken the detour of the mommy-daddy track be as far along as those who haven't? Asked Pernick. I reluctantly have to say that it would not be fair. And is it fair that men and women with children lose out to others who have been working the 12-hour days? She believes it is. Oh my. This brought a storm of protest from younger feminists, women who, under the new dispensation, get the four-day weeks and the extended family leave, and expect, nonetheless, to remain on the same professional footing as their childless colleagues. This is eminently fair, eminently non-discriminatory. Indeed, earlier this month, President Clinton issued a federal ban on the glass ceiling for parents. But imagine how it feels to those like Pernick. They are asked to stretch themselves and cover for a younger colleague so that she can go home and give her child a bath, a joy they will never know, a joy they deliberately gave up under the terms of the original feminist contract, in the name of autonomy and advancement. That contract has now been largely rewritten. But for them, alas, too late. The good that feminism has wrought is quite incalculable. It gave half of humanity the chance to develop, something that had been denied it in practically every culture and every era. But like all great revolutions, feminism has its price and its victims. The Washington Post, May 12, 2000. Ambiguity and affirmative action. The Supreme Court decision upholding affirmative action is incoherent, disingenuous, intellectually muddled, and morally confused, yet it is welcome. Let me explain. Affirmative action began as an attempt to compensate for the effects of past discrimination against African Americans. 40 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, however, that justification is increasingly difficult to maintain. Proponents have accordingly reinvented the rationale. Affirmative action has metastasized into diversity, in whose name an arbitrary selection of favored minorities, at Michigan, blacks, Hispanics, and Native Americans, is entitled to favors denied other Americans purely because of their ethnicity and race. In the Michigan Law School case, the court justified allowing official racial discrimination, the majority opinion itself uses the term racial preferences, in order to achieve diversity. Why? Because a critical mass of minorities improves the educational environment. For this, the justices relied on some social science. In fact, there is contrary social science, but the real question is, should we be violating the fundamental principle of equality before the law in order to attain a speculative minor improvement in the study environment of a university? And even if we grant the existence of this marginal gain, it is grossly outweighed by the huge social, moral, and human costs of racial discrimination. 1. The stigmatization of all minority achievement as it gratuitously opens the question of whether any minority person in high position got there by merit or by skin color. 2. The racial antagonism automatically engendered when race is used to prefer or penalize innocent citizens. 3. The ruin of a legion of minority students who are artificially promoted to institutions where they cannot compete academically and where they, therefore, fail when they could have been brilliant successes at institutions more suited to their academic abilities. Before affirmative action was banned at the University of California at Berkeley, the non-graduation rate for whites was 16%. For blacks, it was 42%. Guilty white liberals could thus point proudly to high minority admissions numbers, caring nothing about the fact that they had turned almost half that cohort, bright young people who might have succeeded elsewhere, into failures. Why, then, am I glad the court, for all of its sophistry, upheld affirmative action? For those who believe that affirmative action, for all of its noble purposes, is extraordinarily destructive to both its beneficiaries and its victims, and to both race relations and constitutional principles, it is tempting to wish it all swept away by the Supreme Court. It is a temptation to be resisted. Issues of this magnitude should never be decided by nine robes. Affirmative action needs to be dealt with by the people in the legislatures and in referendums. I believe that the current dispensation is a travesty. But a very substantial portion of the population reads the Constitution and the nation's needs quite differently. Under these circumstances, the issue should not be settled by judicial fiat. We learned from the abortion issue the doleful consequences of such judicial imperialism. In 1973, changes in public opinion and action in state legislatures were altering the landscape on abortion, at which point the court stepped in and took the issue out of the political arena. As Ruth Bader Ginsburg argued before she ascended to the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade halted a political process that was moving in a reform direction and thereby, I believe, prolonged divisiveness and deferred stable settlement of the issue. The result has been 30 years of strife and agitation as a disenfranchised minority continues to carry the fight against policy for which it has no political recourse. It would be a pity to reenact the experience with affirmative action. Popular referendums have already abolished racial preferences in California and Washington State. Such acts of abolition enjoy the kind of political legitimacy that, as conservatives, of all people, should acknowledge, is lacking when handed down by unelected judges. Let's remember, the court did not mandate affirmative action. It only permitted affirmative action. The people and the politicians are entirely empowered to do away with it. True, the abolition movement has slowed since its successes in California and Washington, and most of the political class, both Democratic and Republican, lacks the courage to take up the fight. But that should tell us something. It tells us that most Americans prefer to abide the current state of unprincipled, muddied racial incoherence so brilliantly reflected in the Supreme Court's Michigan Law School decision. It tells us, too, where the problem lies. We should not be blaming the Supreme Court for refusing to do for us what we, the people in Congress and state legislatures assembled, refuse to do for ourselves. The Washington Post, June 27, 2003. Massacre at Newtown. Every mass shooting has three elements: the killer, the weapon, and the cultural climate. As soon as the shooting stops, partisans immediately pick their preferred root cause with corresponding pet panacea. Names are hurled, scapegoats paraded, prejudices vented. The argument goes nowhere. Let's be serious. Number one, the weapon. Within hours of last week's Newtown, Connecticut massacre, the focus was the weapon, and the demand was for new gun laws. Several prominent pro-gun Democrats remorsefully professed new openness to gun control. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat, California, is introducing a new assault weapons ban. And the president emphasized guns and ammo above all else in announcing the creation of a new task force. I have no problem in principle with gun control. Congress enacted, and I supported, an assault weapons ban in 1994. The problem was, it didn't work. So concluded a University of Pennsylvania study commissioned by the Justice Department. The reason is simple. Unless you are prepared to confiscate all existing firearms, disarm the citizenry, and repeal the Second Amendment, it's almost impossible to craft a law that will be effective. Feinstein's law, for example, would exempt 900 weapons, and that's the least of the loopholes. Even the guns that are banned can be made legal with simple minor modifications. Most fatal, however, is the grandfathering of existing weapons and magazines. That's one of the reasons the 94 law failed. At the time, there were 1.5 million assault weapons in circulation and 25 million large capacity, that is, more than 10 bullets, magazines. A reservoir that immense can take 100 years to draw down. Number two, the killer. Monsters shall always be with us, but in earlier days they did not roam free. As a psychiatrist in Massachusetts in the 1970s, I committed people, often right out of the emergency room, as a danger to themselves or to others. I never did so lightly, but I labored under none of the crushing bureaucratic and legal constraints that make involuntary commitment infinitely more difficult today. Why do you think we have so many homeless? Destitution? Poverty has declined since the 1950s. The majority of those sleeping on grates are mentally ill. In the name of civil liberties, we let them die with their rights on. A tiny percentage of the mentally ill become mass killers. Just about everyone around Tucson shooter Jared Loughner sensed he was mentally ill and dangerous. But in effect, he had to kill before he could be put away and forcibly treated. Random mass killings were three times more common in the 2000s than in the 1980s, when gun laws were actually weaker. Yet a 2011 University of California at Berkeley study found that states with strong civil commitment laws have about a one-third lower homicide rate. Number three, the culture. We live in an entertainment culture soaked in graphic, often sadistic violence. Older folks find themselves stunned by what a desensitized youth finds routine, often amusing. It's not just movies. Young men sit for hours pulling video game triggers, mowing down human beings en masse without pain or consequence. And we profess shock when a small cadre of unstable, deeply deranged, dangerously isolated young men go out and enact the overlearned narrative. If we're serious about curtailing future Columbines and Newtowns, everything, guns, commitment, culture, must be on the table. It's not hard for President Obama to call out the NRA, but will he call out the ACLU? And will he call out his Hollywood friends? The irony is that over the last 30 years, the U.S. homicide rate has declined by 50%. Gun murders as well. We're living not through an epidemic of gun violence, but through a historic decline. Except for these unfathomable mass murders, but these are infinitely more difficult to prevent. While law deters the rational, it has far less effect on the psychotic. The best we can do is to try to detain them, disarm them, and discourage entertainment that can intensify already murderous impulses. But there's a cost. Gun control impinges upon the Second Amendment. Involuntary commitment impinges upon the Liberty Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Curbing entertainment violence impinges upon First Amendment free speech. That's a lot of impingement, a lot of amendments. But there's no free lunch. Increasing public safety almost always means restricting liberties. We made that trade after 9/11. We make it every time the Transportation Security Administration invades your body at an airport. How much are we prepared to trade away after Newtown? The Washington Post, December 20th, 2012. Pandora and polygamy. And now, polygamy. With the sweetly titled HBO series Big Love, polygamy comes out of the closet. Under the headline, Polygamists Unite, Newsweek informs us of polygamy activists emerging in the wake of the gay marriage movement. Says one evangelical Christian big lover, polygamy rights is the next civil rights battle. Polygamy used to be stereotyped as the province of secretive Mormons, primitive Africans, and profligate Arabs. With Big Love, it moves to suburbia as a mere alternative lifestyle. As Newsweek notes, these stirrings for the mainstreaming of polygamy, or more accurately, polyamory, have their roots in the increasing legitimization of gay marriage. In an essay 10 years ago, I pointed out that it is utterly logical for polygamy rights to follow gay rights. After all, if traditional marriage is defined as the union of, number one, two people, of, number two, opposite gender, and if, as advocates of gay marriage insist, the gender requirement is nothing but prejudice, exclusion, and an arbitrary denial of one's autonomous choices in love, then the first requirement, the number restriction, two and only two, is a similarly arbitrary, discriminatory, and indefensible denial of individual choice. This line of argument makes gay activists furious. I can understand why they do not want to be in the same room as polygamists, but I'm not the one who put them there. Their argument does. Blogger and author Andrew Sullivan, who had the courage to advocate gay marriage at a time when it was considered pretty crazy, has called this the polygamy diversion, arguing that homosexuality and polygamy are categorically different because polygamy is a mere activity, while homosexuality is an intrinsic state that occupies a deeper level of human consciousness. But this distinction between higher and lower orders of love is precisely what gay rights activists so vigorously protest. When the general culture privileges, as they say in the English departments, heterosexual unions over homosexual ones. Was Jules Jim and Jean Moreau, the classic Truffaut film involving two dear friends in love with the same woman, about an activity or about the most intrinsic of human emotions? To simplify the logic, take out the complicating factor of gender mixing. Posit a union of, say, three gay women, all deeply devoted to each other. On what grounds would gay activists dismiss their union as mere activity rather than authentic love and self-expression? On what grounds do they insist upon the traditional, arbitrary, and exclusionary number of two? What is historically odd is that as gay marriage is gaining acceptance, the resistance to polygamy is much more powerful. Yet until this generation, gay marriage had been sanctioned by no society that we know of, anywhere at any time in history. On the other hand, polygamy was sanctioned, indeed common in large parts of the world through large swaths of history, most notably the biblical Middle East and through much of the Islamic world. I'm not one of those who see gay marriage or polygamy as a threat to or assault on traditional marriage. The assault came from within. Marriage has needed no help in managing its own long, slow suicide, thank you. Astronomical rates of divorce and of single parenthood, the deliberate creation of fatherless families, existed before there was a single gay marriage or any talk of sanctioning polygamy. The minting of these new forms of marriage is a symptom of our culture's contemporary radical individualism, as is the decline of traditional marriage, and not its cause. As for gay marriage, I've come to a studied ambivalence. I think it is a mistake for society to make this ultimate declaration of indifference between gay and straight life, if only for reasons of pedagogy. On the other hand, I have gay friends and feel the pain of their inability to have the same level of social approbation and confirmation of their relationship with a loved one, but I'm not about to go to anyone's barricade to deny them that. It is critical, however, that any such fundamental change in the very definition of marriage be enacted democratically and not, as in the disastrous case of abortion, by judicial fiat. Call me agnostic, but don't tell me that we can make one radical change in the one-man, one-woman rule and not be open to the claim of others that their reformation be given equal respect. The Washington Post, March 17, 2006. Empathy or right? There are two ways to defend gay marriage. Argument A is empathy. One is influenced by gay friends and committed relationships yearning for the fulfillment and acceptance that marriage conveys upon heterosexuals. That's essentially the case President Obama made when he first announced his change of views. No talk about rights, just human fellow feeling. Such an argument is attractive because it can be compelling without being compulsory. Many people, feeling the weight of this longing among their gay friends, are willing to redefine marriage for the sake of simple human sympathy. At the same time, however, one can sympathize with others who feel great trepidation at the radical transformation of the most fundamental of social institutions, one that, until yesterday, was heterosexual in all societies, in all places, at all times. The empathy argument both encourages mutual respect in the debate and lends itself to a political program of gradualism. State by state, let community norms and moral sensibilities prevail. Indeed, that is Obama's stated position. Such pluralism allows for the kind of stable settlement of the issue that Ruth Bader Ginsburg once lamented had been halted by Roe v. Wade regarding abortion, an issue as morally charged and politically unbridgeable as gay marriage. Argument B is more uncompromising. You have the right to marry anyone regardless of gender. The right to marriage equality is today's civil rights, voting rights, and women's rights, and just as inviolable. Argument B has extremely powerful implications. First, if same-sex marriage is a right, then there is no possible justification for letting states decide for themselves. How can you countenance even one state outlawing a fundamental right? Indeed, half a century ago, states' rights was the cry of those committed to continued segregation and discrimination. Second, if marriage equality is a civil right, then denying it on the basis of, innately felt, sexual orientation is, like discrimination on the basis of skin color, simple bigotry. California's Proposition 8 was overturned by a Ninth Circuit panel on the grounds that the referendum, reaffirming marriage as between a man and woman, was nothing but an expression of bias, serves no purpose other than to lessen the status and human dignity of gays and lesbians. Pretty strong stuff. Which is why it was so surprising that Obama, after first advancing Argument A, went on 5 days later to adopt Argument B, calling gay marriage a great example of expanding rights, and today's successor to civil rights, voting rights, women's rights, and workers' rights. Problem is, it's a howling contradiction to leave up to the states an issue Obama now says is a right. And beyond being intellectually untenable, Obama's embrace of the more hardline rights argument compels him logically to see believers in traditional marriage as purveyors of bigotry. Not a good place for a president to be in an evenly divided national debate that requires both sides to offer each other a modicum of respect. No wonder that Obama has been trying to get away from the issue as quickly as possible. It's not just the New York Times poll showing his new position to be a net loser. It's that he is too intelligent not to realize he's embraced a logical contradiction. Moreover, there is the problem of the obvious cynicism of his conversion. 2/3 of Americans see his evolution as a matter not of principle but of politics. In fact, the change is not at all an evolution, a teleological term cleverly chosen to suggest movement toward a higher state of being, given that Obama came out for gay marriage 16 years ago and then flip-flopped. He was pro when running for the Illinois legislature from ultra-liberal Hyde Park. He became anti when running 8 years later for the U.S. Senate and had to appeal to a decidedly more conservative statewide constituency, and now he's pro again. When a Republican engages in such finger-to-the-wind political calculation, on abortion, for example, he's condemned as a flip-flopper. When a liberal goes through a similar gyration, He's said to have evolved into some more highly realized creature, deserving of a halo on the cover of a national news magazine. Notwithstanding a comically fawning press, Obama knows he has boxed himself in. His rights argument compels him to nationalize same-sex marriage and sharpen hostility towards proponents of traditional marriage, a place he is loath to go. True, he was rushed into it by his loquacious vice president, but surely he could have thought this through. The Washington Post, May 17, 2012. First, a wall, then amnesty. Every sensible immigration policy has two objectives. Number one, to regain control of our borders, so that it is we who decide who enters, and number two, to find a way to normalize and legalize the situation of the 11 million illegals among us. Start with the second. No one of goodwill wants to see these 11 million suffer. But the obvious problem is that legalization creates an enormous incentive for new illegals to come. We say, of course, that this will be the very last, very final, never again, we're not kidding this time, amnesty. The problem is that we say exactly the same thing with every new reform, and everyone knows it's phony. What do you think was said when in 1986 we passed the Simpson-Mazzoli immigration reform? It turned into the largest legalization program in American history. Nearly 3 million got permanent residency. And we are now back at it again with 11 million new illegals in our midst. How can it be otherwise? We already have a river of people coming every day knowing they're going to be illegal and perhaps even exploited. They come nonetheless. The newest amnesty, the earned legalization now being dangled in front of them by proposed Senate legislation, can only increase the flow. Those who think employer sanctions will control immigration are dreaming. Employer sanctions were the heart of Simpson-Mazzoli. They are not only useless, they are pernicious. They turn employers into enforcers of border control. That is a job of government, not landscapers. The irony of this whole debate, which is bitterly splitting the country along partisan, geographic, and ethnic lines, is that there is a silver bullet that would not just solve the problem, but also create a national consensus behind it. My proposition is the following. A vast number of Americans who oppose legalization and fear new waves of immigration would change their minds if we could radically reduce new, that is, future, illegal immigration. Forget employer sanctions. Build a barrier. It is simply ridiculous to say it cannot be done. If one fence won't do it, then build a second, 100 yards behind it, and then build a road for patrols in between, put cameras, put sensors, put out lots of patrols. Can't be done? Israel's border fence has been extraordinarily successful in keeping out potential infiltrators who are far more determined than mere immigrants. Nor have very many North Koreans crossed into South Korea in the last 50 years. Of course, it will be ugly. So are the concrete barriers to keep truck bombs from driving into the White House. But sometimes, necessity trumps aesthetics. And don't tell me that this is our Berlin Wall. When you build a wall to keep people in, that's a prison. When you build a wall to keep people out, that's an expression of sovereignty. The fence around your house is a perfectly legitimate expression of your desire to control who comes into your house to eat, sleep, and use the facilities. It imprisons no one. Of course, no barrier will be foolproof, but it doesn't have to be. It simply has to reduce the river of illegals to a manageable trickle. Once we can do that, everything becomes possible, most especially humanizing the situation of our 11 million existing illegals. If the government can demonstrate that it can control future immigration, there will be infinitely less resistance to dealing generously with the residual population of past immigration. And, as Mickey Kaus and others have suggested, that may require that the two provisions be sequenced. First, radical border control by physical means. Then, shortly thereafter, radical legalization of those already here. To achieve national consensus on legalization, we will need a short lag time between the two provisions, perhaps a year or two, to demonstrate to the skeptics that the current wave of illegals is indeed the last. This is no time for mushy compromise. A solution requires two acts of national will: the ugly act of putting up a fence, and the supremely generous act of absorbing as ultimately full citizens those who broke our laws to come to America. This is not a compromise meant to appease both sides without achieving anything. It is not some piece of hybrid legislation that arbitrarily divides illegals into those with five-year-old roots in America and those without, or some such mischief-making nonsense. This is full amnesty, earned with back taxes and learning English and the like, with full border control. If we do it right, not only will we solve the problem, we will get it done as one nation. The Washington Post, April 7, 2006. In plain English, let's make it official. Growing up as I did, in the province of Quebec, you learn not just the joys but also the perils of bilingualism. A separate national identity revolving entirely around Francophony became a raging issue that led to social unrest, terrorism, threats of separation, and a referendum that came within a hair's breadth of breaking up Canada. Canada, of course, had no choice about bilingualism. It is a country created of two nations at its birth, and has ever since been trying to cope with that inherently divisive fact. The United States, by contrast, blessed with a single common language for two centuries, seems blithely and gratuitously to be ready to import bilingualism with all its attendant divisiveness and antagonisms. One of the major reasons for America's great success as the world's first universal nation, for its astonishing and unmatched capacity for assimilating immigrants, has been that an automatic part of acculturation was the acquisition of English. And yet, during the great immigration debate now raging in Congress, the people's representatives cannot make up their minds whether the current dominance of English should be declared a national asset worthy of enshrinement in law. The Senate could not bring itself to declare English the country's official language. The best it could do was pass an amendment to the immigration bill, tepidly declaring English the national language. Yet even that was too much for Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid, who called that resolution racist. Less hyperbolic opponents point out that granting special official status to English is simply unnecessary. America has been accepting foreign language-speaking immigrants forever. Brooklyn is so polyglot, it is a veritable babble, and yet we've done just fine. What's the great worry about Spanish? The worry is this. Polyglot is fine when immigrants like those in Brooklyn are members of a myriad of linguistic communities, each tiny and discreet. There is no threat to the common culture. No immigrant presumes to make the demand that the state grant special status to his language. He may speak it in the street and proudly teach it to his children, but he knows that his future, and certainly theirs, lie inevitably in learning English as the gateway to American life. But all of that changes when you have an enormous linguistically monoclonal immigration as we do today from Latin America. Then you get not Brooklyn's successful babble, but Canada's restive Quebec. Monoclonal immigration is new for the United States, and it changes things radically. If at the turn of the 20th century, Ellis Island had greeted teeming masses speaking not 50 languages, but just, say, German, America might not have enjoyed the same success at assimilation and national unity that it has. Today's monoclonal linguistic culture is far from hypothetical. Growing rapidly through immigration, it creates large communities, in some places already majorities, so overwhelmingly Spanish-speaking that in time, they may quite naturally demand the rights and official recognition for Spanish that French has in French-speaking Quebec. That would not be the end of the world. Canada is a decent place, but the beginning of a new one for the United States, a world far more complicated and fraught with division. History has blessed us with all the freedom and advantages of multiculturalism, but it has also blessed us, because of the accident of our origins, with a linguistic unity that brings a critically needed cohesion to a nation as diverse, multiracial, and multi-ethnic as America. Why gratuitously throw away that priceless asset? How mindless to call the desire to retain it racist. I speak three languages. My late father spoke nine. When he became a naturalized American in mid-century, it never occurred to him to demand of his new and beneficent land that whenever its government had business with him, tax forms, court proceedings, ballot boxes, that it should be required to communicate in French, his best language, rather than English, his last and relatively weakest. English is America's national and common language, but that may change over time unless we change our assimilation norms. Making English the official language is the first step toward establishing those norms. Official means the language of the government and its institutions. Official makes clear our expectations of acculturation. Official means that every citizen, upon entering America's most sacred political space, the voting booth, should minimally be able to identify the words president and vice president and county commissioner and judge. The immigrant, of course, has the right to speak whatever he wants, but he must understand that when he comes to the United States, swears allegiance, and accepts its bounty, he undertakes to join its civic culture. In English. Time, June 5th, 2006. Of course it's a Ponzi scheme. The Great Social Security Debate, Proposition 1. Of course it's a Ponzi scheme. In a Ponzi scheme, the people who invest early get their money out with dividends. But these dividends don't come from any profitable or productive activity. They consist entirely of money paid in by later participants. This cannot go on forever because at some point there just aren't enough new investors to support the earlier entrants. Word gets around that there are no profits, just money transferred from new to old. The merry-go-round stops, the scheme collapses, and the remaining investors lose everything. Now, Social Security is a pay-as-you-go program. A current beneficiary isn't receiving the money she paid in years ago. That money is gone. It went to her parents' Social Security check. The money in her check is coming from her son's FICA tax today. That is, her investment was paid out years ago to earlier entrants in the system, and her current benefits are coming from the investment of the new entrants into the system. Pay-as-you-go is the definition of a Ponzi scheme. So what's the difference? Ponzi schemes are illegal, suggested one of my colleagues on Inside Washington. But this is perfectly irrelevant. Imagine that Charles Ponzi had lived not in Boston, but in the lesser parts of Papua New Guinea, where the securities and fraud laws were, shall we say, less developed. He runs his same scheme among the locals. Give me, invest, one goat today. I'll give, return, you two after six full moons, but escapes any legal sanction. Is his legal enterprise any less a Ponzi scheme? Of course not. So what is the difference? Proposition 2. The crucial distinction between a Ponzi scheme and Social Security is that Social Security is mandatory. That's why Ponzi schemes always collapse, and Social Security has not. When it's mandatory, you've ensured an endless supply of new participants. Indeed, if Charles Ponzi had had the benefit of the law forcing people into his scheme, he'd still be going strong and a perfect candidate for commissioner of the Social Security Administration. But there's a catch. Compulsion allows sustainability. It does not guarantee it. Hence, Proposition 3. Even a mandatory Ponzi scheme such as Social Security can fail if it cannot rustle up enough new entrants. You can force young people into Social Security, but if there just aren't enough young people in existence to support current beneficiaries, the system will collapse anyway. When Social Security began making monthly distributions in 1940, there were 160 workers for every senior receiving benefits. In 1950, there were 16.5. Today, 3. In 20 years, there will be but 2. Now the average senior receives in Social Security about a third of what the average worker makes. Applying that ratio retroactively, this means that in 1940, the average worker had to pay only 0.2% of his salary to sustain the older folks of his time. In 1950, 2%. Today, 11%. In 20 years, 17%. This is a staggering sum, considering that it is in addition to all the other taxes he pays to sustain other functions of government, such as Medicare, whose costs are exploding. The Treasury already steps in and borrows the money required to cover the gap between what workers pay into Social Security and what seniors take out. When young people were plentiful, Social Security produced a surplus. Starting now and for decades to come, it will add to the deficit, increasingly so as the population ages. Demography is destiny, which leads directly to Proposition 4. This is one Ponzi scheme that can be saved by adapting to the new demographics. 3 easy steps. Change the cost of living measure, means test for richer recipients, and most important, raise the retirement age. The current retirement age is an absurd anachronism. Bismarck arbitrarily chose 70 when he created social insurance in 1889. Clever guy. Life expectancy at the time was under 50. When Franklin Roosevelt created Social Security, choosing 65 as the eligibility age, life expectancy was 62. Today, it is almost 80. FDR wanted to prevent the aged few from suffering destitution in their last remaining years. Social Security was not meant to provide 2 decades of greens fees for baby boomers. Of course it's a Ponzi scheme. So what? It's also the most vital, humane, and fixable of all social programs. The question for the candidates is, forget Ponzi. Are you going to fix Social Security? The Washington Post, September 15, 2011. The Church of Global Warming. I'm not a global warming believer. I'm not a global warming denier. I'm a global warming agnostic who believes instinctively that it can't be very good to pump lots of CO2 into the atmosphere, but is equally convinced that those who presume to know exactly where that leads are talking through their hats. Predictions of catastrophe depend on models. Models depend on assumptions about complex planetary systems, from ocean currents to cloud formation, that no one fully understands, which is why the models are inherently flawed and forever changing. The doomsday scenarios posit a cascade of events, each with a certain probability. The multiple improbability of their simultaneous occurrence renders all such predictions entirely speculative. Yet on the basis of this speculation, environmental activists, attended by compliant scientists and opportunistic politicians, are advocating radical economic and social regulation. The largest threat to freedom, democracy, the market economy, and prosperity, warns Czech President Václav Klaus, is no longer socialism. It is, instead, the ambitious, arrogant, unscrupulous ideology of environmentalism. If you doubt the arrogance, you haven't seen that Newsweek cover story that declared the global warming debate over. Consider, if Newton's laws of motion could, after 200 years of unfailing experimental and experiential confirmation, be overthrown, it requires religious fervor to believe that global warming, infinitely more untested, complex, and speculative, is a closed issue. But declaring it closed has its rewards. It not only dismisses skeptics as the running dogs of reaction, that is, of Exxon, Cheney, and now Klaus. By fiat, it also hugely re-empowers the intellectual left. For a century, an ambitious, arrogant, unscrupulous knowledge class, social planners, scientists, intellectuals, experts, and their left-wing political allies, arrogated to themselves the right to rule either in the name of the oppressed working class, communism, or in its more benign form, by virtue of their superior expertise in achieving the highest social progress by means of state planning, socialism. 2 decades ago, however, socialism and communism died rudely, then were buried forever by the empirical demonstration of the superiority of market capitalism everywhere from Thatcher's England to Deng's China, where just the partial abolition of socialism lifted more people out of poverty more rapidly than ever in human history. Just as the ash heap of history beckoned, the intellectual left was handed the ultimate salvation, environmentalism. Now the experts will regulate your life not in the name of the proletariat or Fabian socialism, but even better, in the name of Earth itself. Environmentalists are Gaia's priests, instructing us in her proper service and casting out those who refuse to genuflect, see Newsweek above. And having proclaimed the ultimate commandment, carbon chastity, they are preparing the supporting canonical legislation that will tell you how much you can travel, what kind of light you will read by, and at what temperature you may set your bedroom thermostat. Only Monday, a British parliamentary committee proposed that every citizen be required to carry a carbon card that must be presented under penalty of law when buying gasoline, taking an airplane, or using electricity. The card contains your yearly carbon ration to be drawn down with every purchase, every trip, every swipe. There's no greater social power than the power to ration. And other than rationing food, there is no greater instrument of social control than rationing energy, the currency of just about everything one does and uses in an advanced society. So, what does the global warming agnostic propose as an alternative? First, more research, untainted and reliable, to determine A, whether the carbon footprint of man is or is not lost among the massive natural forces, from sunspot activity to ocean currents, that affect climate, and B, if the human effect is indeed significant, whether the planetary climate system has the homeostatic mechanisms like the feedback loops in the human body, for example, with which to compensate. Second, reduce our carbon footprint in the interim by doing the doable, rather than the economically ruinous and socially destructive. The most obvious step is a major move to nuclear power, which to the atmosphere is the cleanest of the clean. But your would-be masters have foreseen this contingency. The Church of the Environment promulgates secondary dogmas as well. One of these is a strict nuclear taboo. Rather convenient, is it not? Take this major coal substituting fix off the table, and we will be rationing all the more. Guess who does the rationing? The Washington Post, May 30th, 2008. Chapter 9. Body and Soul. The Dutch example. In 1991, in the Dutch city of Assen, a perfectly healthy 50-year-old woman asked her doctor to help her die. Her two sons had died, one by suicide, one by cancer. She wanted to join them. After many hours of consultation, Dr. Boudewijn Chabot consented. He was at her side when she swallowed the lethal pills he prescribed for her death. In Holland, physician-assisted suicide is for all practical purposes legal, but Dr. Chabot was tried anyway because this woman wasn't terminally ill. She wasn't even ill. In fact, she wasn't even psychiatrically ill, a point that at trial Dr. Chabot made in his own defense. She was as lucid as she was inconsolable. The three-judge court in Assen acquitted Dr. Chabot. So did an appeals court. So did the Dutch Supreme Court. Thus, notes Dr. Herbert Hinden, in his indispensable study of euthanasia in Holland, seduced by death, doctors, patients, and the Dutch cure, has Holland legally established mental suffering as a basis for euthanasia. Why is this important for Americans? Because on Wednesday, the U.S. Supreme Court was asked to decide whether physician-assisted suicide should be legal in America, as in Holland. The two cases before the court both involved the terminally ill, but the deployment of these heart-rending cases of terminal illness is part of the cunning of the euthanasia advocates. They are pulling heartstrings to get us to open the door, and once the door opens, it opens to everyone, terminally ill or not. How do we know? At oral arguments on Wednesday, Justice David Souter asked that question in one form or another at least four times. Once you start by allowing euthanasia for the terminally ill, what evidence is there that abuses will follow? The answer, in a word, is Holland. I'm not even talking here about the 1,000 cases a year. In the United States, that would translate into 20,000 cases a year of Dutch patients put to death by their doctors without their consent. Most, by the way, are killed not for reasons of pain, but, as the doctors put it, for low quality of life, or because all treatment was withdrawn but the patient did not die. I'm talking here about Dutch doctors helping the suicide of people not terminally ill, not chronically ill, not ill at all, but, like Our Lady of Assen, merely bereft. Eugene Sartorius, the prominent Dutch attorney who defended Dr. Chabot, said after winning his case, "Euthanasia, which started with terminal illness, has moved to a different plane." And so it must. Why? Because in moving to a different plane, the Dutch were not being perverse, they were being logical. By what logical principle should the relief of death be granted only the terminally ill? Such a restriction is itself perverse. After all, the terminally ill face only a brief period of suffering. The chronically ill, or the healthy but bereft, they face a lifetime of agony. Why deny them the relief of a humane exit? The litigants before the Supreme Court, however, claimed the right to assisted suicide on the grounds not of mercy, but of liberty. The autonomy of individuals to determine when and how they will die. But on what logical grounds can this autonomy be reserved only for the terminally ill? Why not for every mentally competent adult? Wednesday at the Supreme Court, the lawyers for the euthanasia side, Catherine Tucker and Lawrence Tribe, turned somersaults trying to answer the question. Tribe offered a riff on the stages of life. Life, though it feels continuous to many of us, has certain critical thresholds. Birth, marriage, childbearing. I think death is one of those thresholds. It nearly got him laughed out of court when Justice Scalia cut him off with, "This is lovely philosophy. Where is it in the Constitution?" Tribe had no answer because there is no answer. If assisted suicide is a right for the terminally ill, there is no argument that can be made to deny it on grounds of mercy or autonomy or non-discrimination to anyone else who might request it. That is why the Supreme Court decision in these two cases will be so fateful. That is why euthanasia advocates are so passionate about them. They know this is the beginning of something much larger, nothing less than historic legitimation through the active, legal, societally blessed participation of the medical profession of suicide. In modern society, suicide is no longer punished. Denial of burial on church grounds, denial of inheritance to the family. But it is still discouraged. When you see someone on a high ledge ready to jump, you are enjoined by every norm in our society to tackle him and pull him back from the abyss. We are now being asked to become a society where, when the tormented soul on the ledge asks for our help in granting him relief, we oblige him with a push. They do it in Assen. The Washington Post, January 10th, 1997. Stem cells and fairy tales. After the second presidential debate in which John Kerry used the word plan 24 times, I said on television that Kerry has a plan for everything except curing psoriasis. I should have known there is no parodying Kerry's pandering. It turned out days later that the Kerry campaign has a plan, nay, a promise, to cure paralysis. What is the plan? Vote for Kerry. This is John Edwards on Monday at a rally in Newton, Iowa. If we do the work that we can do in this country, the work that we will do when John Kerry is president, people like Christopher Reeve are going to walk. Get up out of that wheelchair and walk again. In my 25 years in Washington, I have never seen a more loathsome display of demagoguery. Hope is good. False hope is bad. Deliberately for personal gain, raising false hope in the catastrophically afflicted is despicable. Where does one begin to deconstruct this outrage? First, the inability of the human spinal cord to regenerate is one of the great mysteries of biology. The answer is not remotely around the corner. It could take a generation to unravel. To imply, as Edwards did, that it is imminent if only you elect the right politicians is scandalous. Second, if the cure for spinal cord injury comes, we have no idea where it will come from. There are many lines of inquiry. Stem cell research is just one of many possibilities, and a very speculative one at that. For 30 years, I have heard promises of miracle cures for paralysis, including my own, suffered as a medical student. The last fad, fetal tissue transplants, was thought to be a sure thing. Nothing came of it. As a doctor by training, I've known better than to believe the hype, and have tried in my own counseling of people with new spinal cord injuries to place the possibility of cure in abeyance. I advise instead to concentrate on making a life, and a very good life it can be, with the hand one is dealt. The greatest enemies of this advice have been the snake oil salesman promising a miracle around the corner. I never expected a candidate for vice president to be one of them. Third, the implication that Christopher Reeve was prevented from getting out of his wheelchair by the Bush stem cell policies is a travesty. George Bush is the first president to approve federal funding for stem cell research. There are 22 lines of stem cells now available, up from one just 2 years ago. As Leon Cass, head of the President's Council on Bioethics, has written, there are 3,500 shipments of stem cells waiting for anybody who wants them. Edwards and Kerry constantly talk of a Bush ban on stem cell research. This is false. There is no ban. You want to study stem cells? You get them from the companies that have the cells and apply to the National Institutes of Health for the federal funding. In his August 7th radio address to the nation, Kerry referred not once, but four times to the ban on stem cell research instituted by Bush. At the time, Reeve was alive, so not available for posthumous exploitation. But Ronald Reagan was available, having recently died of Alzheimer's. So what does Kerry do? He begins his radio address with the disgraceful claim that the stem cell ban is standing in the way of an Alzheimer's cure. This is an outright lie. The President's Council on Bioethics, on which I sit, had one of the world's foremost experts on Alzheimer's, Dennis Selko from Harvard, give us a lecture on the newest and most promising approaches to solving the Alzheimer's mystery. Selko reported remarkable progress in using biochemicals to clear the plaque deposits in the brain that lead to Alzheimer's. He ended his presentation without the phrase stem cells having passed his lips. So much for the miracle cure. Ronald D.G. McKay, a stem cell researcher at NIH, has admitted publicly that stem cells as an Alzheimer's cure are a fiction, but that people need a fairy tale. Carrie and Edwards certainly do. They are shamelessly exploiting this fairy tale, having no doubt been told by their pollsters that stem cells play well politically for them. Politicians have long promised a chicken in every pot. It is part of the game. It is one thing to promise ethanol subsidies here, dairy price controls there, but to exploit the desperate hopes of desperate people with the promise of Christ-like cures is beyond the pale. There is no apologizing for Edwards' remark. It is too revealing. There is absolutely nothing the man will not say to get elected. The Washington Post, October 15, 2004. The truth about end-of-life counseling. Let's see if we can have a reasoned discussion about end-of-life counseling. We might start by asking Sarah Palin to leave the room. I've got nothing against her. She's a remarkable political talent. But there are no death panels in the Democratic health care bills, and to say that there are is to debase the debate. We also have to tell the defenders of the notorious Section 1233 of H.R. 3200 that it is not quite as benign as they pretend. To offer government reimbursement to any doctor who gives end-of-life counseling, whether or not the patient asked for it, is to create an incentive for such a chat. What do you think such a chat would be like? Do you think the doctor will go on and on about the fantastic new million-dollar high-tech gizmo that can prolong the patient's otherwise hopeless condition for another 6 months? Or do you think he's going to talk about, as the bill specifically spells out, hospice care and palliative care and other ways of letting go of life? No, say the defenders, it's just that we want the doctors to talk to you about putting in place a living will and other such instruments. Really? Then consider the actual efficacy of a living will. When you are old, infirm, and lying in the ICU with Pseudomonas pneumonia and deciding whether to A, go through the long antibiotic treatment, or B, allow what used to be called the old man's friend to take you away, the doctor will ask you at that time what you want for yourself, no matter what piece of paper you signed 5 years earlier. You are told constantly how very important it is to write your living will years in advance. But the relevant question is what you desire at the end, when facing death, not what you felt sometime in the past when you were hale and hearty and sitting in your lawyer's office barely able to contemplate a life of pain and diminishment. Well, as pain and diminishment enter your life as you age, your calculations change and your tolerance for suffering increases. In the ICU, you might have a new way of looking at things. My own living will, which I have always considered more a literary than a legal document, basically says, I've had some good innings, thank you. If I have anything so much as a hangnail, pull the plug. I've never taken it terribly seriously because unless I'm comatose or demented, they're going to ask me at the time whether or not I want to be resuscitated if I go into cardiac arrest. The paper I signed years ago will mean nothing. And if I'm totally out of it, my family will decide with little or no reference to my living will. Why? I'll give you an example. When my father was dying, my mother and brother and I had to decide how much treatment to pursue. What was a better way to ascertain my father's wishes? What he checked off on a form one fine summer's day years before being stricken, or what we, who had known him intimately for decades, thought he would want? The answer is obvious. Except for the demented orphan, the living will is quite beside the point. The one time it really is essential is if you think your fractious family will be only too happy to hasten your demise to get your money. That's what the law is good at, protecting you from murder and theft. But that is a far cry from assuring a peaceful and willed death, which is what most people imagine living wills are about. So why get Medicare to pay the doctor to do the counseling? Because we know that if this white-coated authority whose chosen vocation is curing and healing is the one opening your mind to hospice and palliative care, we've nudged you ever so slightly toward letting go. It's not an outrage. It's surely not a death panel, but it is subtle pressure applied by society through your doctor. And when you include it in a healthcare reform whose major objective is to bend the cost curve downward, you have to be a fool or a knave to deny that it's intended to gently point the patient in a certain direction, toward the corner of the sick room where stands a ghostly figure, scythe in hand, offering release. The Washington Post, August 21st, 2009. Mass murder, medicalized. What a surprise that someone who shouts, Allahu Akbar, the God is great jihadist battle cry, as he is shooting up a room full of American soldiers might have Islamist motives. It certainly was a surprise to the mainstream media, which spent the weekend after the Fort Hood massacre playing down Nidal Hassan's religious beliefs. I cringe that he's a Muslim. I think he's probably just a nutcase, said Newsweek's Evan Thomas. Some were more adamant. Times' Joe Klein decried odious attempts by Jewish extremists to argue that the massacre perpetrated by Nidal Hassan was somehow a direct consequence of his Islamic beliefs. While none could match Klein's peculiar Cherchez les Juifs motif, the popular storyline was of an army psychiatrist driven over the edge by terrible stories he had heard from soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. They suffered. He listened. He snapped. Really? What about the doctors and nurses, the counselors and physical therapists at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, who every day hear and live with the pain and the suffering of returning soldiers? How many of them then picked up a gun and shot 51 innocents? And what about civilian psychiatrists? Not the Upper West Side therapist treating Woody Allen neurotics, but the thousands of doctors working with hospitalized psychotics, who every day hear not just tales but cries of the most excruciating anguish, of the most unimaginable torment. How many of those doctors commit mass murder? It's been decades since I practiced psychiatry. Perhaps I missed the epidemic. But of course, if the shooter is named Nidal Hassan, who National Public Radio reported had been trying to proselytize doctors and patients, then something must be found. Presto, secondary post-traumatic stress disorder, a handy invention to allow one to ignore the obvious. And the perfect moral finesse. Medicalizing mass murder not only exonerates, it turns the murderer into a victim, indeed a sympathetic one. After all, secondary PTSD, for those who believe in it, you won't find it in DSM-4-TR, psychiatry's diagnostic and statistical manual, is known as compassion fatigue. The poor man pushed over the edge by an excess of sensitivity. Have we totally lost our moral bearings? Nidal Hassan cold-bloodedly killed 13 innocent people. His business card had his name, his profession, his medical degrees, and his occupational identity. U.S. Army? No. SOA, Soldier of Allah. In such cases, political correctness is not just an abomination, it's a danger, clear and present. Consider the Army's treatment of Hassan's previous behavior. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling interviewed a Hassan colleague at Walter Reed about a hair-raising grand rounds that Hassan had apparently given. Grand rounds are the most serious academic event at a teaching hospital. Attending physicians, residents, and students gather for a lecture on an instructive case history or therapeutic finding. I've been to dozens of these. In fact, I gave one myself on post-traumatic retrograde amnesia. As you can see, these lectures are fairly technical. Not Hassan's. His was an hour-long disquisition on what he called the Quranic view of military service, jihad, and war. It included an allegedly authoritative elaboration of the punishments visited upon non-believers, consignment to hell, decapitation, having hot oil poured down your throat. This really freaked a lot of doctors out, reported NPR. Nor was this the only incident. The psychiatrist, reported Zwerdling, said that he was the kind of guy who the staff actually stood around in the hallway saying, "Do you think he's a terrorist, or is he just weird?" Was anything done about this potential danger? Of course not. Who wants to be accused of Islamophobia and prejudice against a colleague's religion? One must not speak of such things, not even now. Not even after we know that Hassan was in communication with a notorious Yemen-based jihad propagandist. As late as Tuesday, the New York Times was running a story on how returning soldiers at Fort Hood had a high level of violence. What does such violence have to do with Hassan? He was not a returning soldier. And the soldiers who returned home and shot their wives or fellow soldiers didn't cry Allahu Akbar as they squeezed the trigger. The delicacy about the religion in question, condescending, politically correct, and deadly, is nothing new. A week after the first 1993 World Trade Center attack, the same New York Times ran the following front-page headline about the arrest of one Mohammed Salameh. Jersey City man is charged in bombing of Trade Center. Ah, yes. Those Jersey men, so resentful of New York, so prone to violence. The Washington Post, November 13, 2009. the double tragedy of a stolen death. Dying is easy. Parking is hard. Art Buchwald's little witticism nicely captured his chosen path to a good death, mocking it to the very end. There is great courage and dignity in that, which is why Buchwald's extended goodbye, he died on January 17th, earned him such appreciation and admiration. But dying well is also a matter of luck. By unexpectedly living almost a full year after refusing dialysis for kidney failure, Buchwald won himself time to taunt the scythe. Timing is everything. When former congressman and distinguished priest and liberal luminary Robert Drinan died earlier this year, the Washington Post published a special appreciation. It ran together with a tribute to another notable who died just one day later, Barbaro. The horse got top billing. And does anyone remember when Mother Teresa died? The greatest saint of our time died on the frenzied eve of the funeral of the greatest diva of our time, Princess Di. In the popular mind, celebrity trumps virtue every time. Consider Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev, tormented in life by Stalin, his patron and jailer. Prokofiev had the extraordinary bad luck of dying on the same day as the great man, ensconcing him forever in the tyrant's shadow, wrote critic Sarah Kaufman of the Washington Post, where he remains branded as a compromised artist. We should all hope to die well. By that I don't mean in the classic Greek sense of dying heroically as in battle. I'm suggesting a much lower standard, just not dying badly. At a minimum, not dying comically, death by banana peel or pratfall, or my favorite, I confess, on stage like the actor Harold Norman, killed in 1947 during an especially energetic sword fight in the last scene of Macbeth. There is also the particularly unwelcome death that not just ends a life but also undoes it, indeed steals it, the way Kitty Genovese's was stolen. On March 13, 1964, she was repeatedly stabbed for 35 minutes in the street and in the foyer of her apartment building in Queens, New York. Many neighbors heard her scream. Not one helped. When the police eventually arrived, it was much too late. Her death became a sensation, her name a metaphor for urban alienation, her last hour an indictment of the pitiless American city. I've always been struck by the double injustice of her murder. Not only did the killer cut short her life amid immense terror and suffering, but he defined it. He, a stranger, an intruder, gave her a perverse immortality of a kind she never sought, never expected, never consented to. She surely thought that in her 28 years she had been building a life of joys and loves, struggle and achievement, friendship and fellowship. That and everything else she built her life into were simply swallowed up by the notoriety of her death, a notoriety unchosen and unbidden. That kind of double death can also result from an act of God. Disease, for example, can not just end your life. If it is exotic and dramatic enough, it can steal your identity as well. Without being consulted, you become an eponym. At least baseball great Lou Gehrig had the time and talent to be remembered for things other than what was generally known as ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Ryan White, a teenager when he died in the early years of the AIDS epidemic, did not. He was hastily conscripted as poster boy for the Ryan White Comprehensive AIDS Resource Emergency, CARE Act, defined by his dying, much like poor Megan Kenka, the little girl murdered by a sex offender in New Jersey, who lives today as Megan's Law. No one grasps more greedily and cruelly the need for agency in death as does the greatest moral monster of our time, the suicide bomber. By choosing not only the time and place, but the blood-soaked story that will accompany his death, he seeks to transcend and redeem an otherwise meaningless life. One day you are the alienated and insignificant Muhammad Atta. The next day, September 11th, 2001, you join the annals of infamy with all the glory that brings in the darker precincts of humanity. It is the ultimate perversion of the good death, done for the worst of motives, self-creation through the annihilation of others. People often denounce such suicide attacks as senseless. On the contrary, they make all too much malevolent sense. There is great power in owning your own death and even greater power in forever dispossessing your infidel victims of theirs. Time, March 1st, 2007.